Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Billboard Chart Beat Podcast. Gary Trust here with an absolute legend coming up here on the podcast, Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees, because 50 years ago, the Monkees made history on Billboard's charts. On the Billboard 200, dated February 11th, 1967, the Monkees' second album, War of the Monkees, hit number one, and it replaced their first album, The Monkees. In total, the group led for 31 straight weeks. And that's a record still in the Billboard 200's about 60-year history. No other act has led for as many as 31 straight weeks. So the Monkees have a pretty big place in Billboard chart history. I was really excited to get Mickey Dolenz on the phone. So nice of him to take some time to chat about what he remembered about setting that record 50 years ago and just all the decades of the Monkees' legacy of entertaining so many people. So Mickey Dolenz coming up here on the Billboard Chart Beat Podcast. And in fact, here they come right now.
Here we come, walking down the street. We get funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees, and people say we monkey around. But we're too busy singing to put anybody down.
You know, as you know the story, we've had decades now pretty wonderful success, including the wonderful new album we did, Good Times. At the time, frankly, I'm sure I'd been told, but I don't recall being told or having any kind of a celebratory party, because we were filming that television show, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day. And at night I was going in and recording, most of the lead vocals, sometimes two or three a night. And then on the weekends we were rehearsing for the tour. And between that and all the publicity and the press and promotion, no, I probably wasn't that aware. And also, I was not that au fait with the music business at the time. I'd done some, I was in a cover band, you know, doing, playing bars and bowling alleys in a cover band. And so I knew a little bit about that part of the business. And then I had done a little recording. I did a song that was eventually released as a Mickey Dolenz song, but I actually recorded it before the Monkees with the Wrecking Crew. And a good friend of mine told me years later, he said, I played on your first record. And I said, oh, really? It was Glenn Campbell. I think years later we became good friends. And he said, yeah, I was on your first session. But, of course, at that age, I was just probably 18 or 19.
Right.
I didn't know much about the recording business or the record business and how that all works. So much happens so fast, you know.
Right.
It's like being in the eye of a hurricane. You just can't absorb anything more, you know. You get that kind of deer caught in the headlights kind of look.
Right. What did you enjoy most about it? It sounds like everything was a whirlwind, and maybe it was just all one big blur for the most part. But did you like making the TV show more, the acting? Did you like going in at night and recording the vocals, or did you love all of it?
Well, I liked all of it. I mean, it was incredibly exciting. And, you know, I approached it as an entertainer. I knew that it was going to require singing and playing, because at the audition you had to be able to sing and play an instrument to get in the audition,
right,
to get through the auditions. And my audition piece, for example, was Johnny B. Goode, because I played acoustic guitar started with classical guitar, you know, Segovia kind of stuff, and as a kid, and then morphed into folk music in the early 60s, and then that morphed into rock and roll. And like I say, I knew the show was more than just about acting, but I was a singer. My parents were both singers. They were both in the business. So, you know, I can't say I liked one bit more than the other. I would say I was probably more comfortable on the television set because I'd already done it. I'd already had a TV series as a kid called Circus Boy.
Right, right.
And the same studio, in fact, and shot parts of it in the same soundstage.
Yeah.
When I showed up on the at Columbia Screen Gems lot, you know, to start working on the series, it was the same guy at the gate that had 10 years earlier known me as Mickey Braddock and Circus Boy. So for me, it was like a home. Even had the same cinematographer that I'd had on Circus Boy. So I was probably more comfortable just because I was familiar with it,
right?
The process. And I was not as familiar with the process of recording yet. But I do remember liking it all. I mean, how can you not when you're selling all those records and you're getting that incredible reaction? And, you know, I look back and some of it amuses me, and I think of, you know, the first time I met the songwriters, Lester Sill, the head of publishing for Screen Gems West Coast, took me to that Brill Building West. I think it was Lou Adler's building, an old converted apartment building. And he said, oh, you should meet the songwriters that are going to be writing for you. And we walked in, and there were these little cubbyhole kind of office spaces, you know, like they divided it all up. And he knocks on the door and opens it, and he says, Mickey Dolenz, this is Carole King. She's going to be writing some songs for you. And she was sitting at a little upright piano with a woolen sack tape recorder on the top. Same one that I had, actually. So, and then down the hall, he knocked on another door. It was David Gates. And then another knocked on another door, and it was, you know, somebody else. But I was totally unfamiliar with, you know, the process and of the business at that time, at that age. But I do remember that. I remember that quite clearly. I don't know why. I remember meeting Carole King for the first time in that little office space. And then, of course, there's the story of Harry Nilsson, who had his first hit with us.
Right.
Cuddly Toy, first recording, Cuddly Toy. And I remember very clearly him coming into the session during headquarters, and Lester Sill brought him in again. And he was working at a bank, as a matter of fact, in the Valley, and trying to sell songs on the side. And Lester Sill brought this guy in, and he said, this is a songwriter, Harry Nilsson. He's going to play a couple of tunes. And he sat down at the piano and played Cuddly Toy. And Davey said, yeah, I'll do that. And years later, Harry and I became very, very good friends, as you may know. And years later, we were talking about it. And he says, yeah, I never told you, but when Lester Sill walked me out into the hallway after that, he looked at me and says, you can quit the bank. That was great.
Did you think it would be a hit show, not just even just at the time, but the way it's become such an institution?
Not at that time. You never know. You don't know in advance. And anybody that tells you they guarantee you a hit is just kidding themselves.
Right.
If, you know, there's no formula. If there was, there would never be a flop. But And over the years, looking back, you know, I've been asked that question so many times. One of the producers, when asked, he says, "We just caught lightning in a bottle." And
yeah.
That's sort of my feeling about it. What you do is, you know, you surround yourself with talented people and you work hard and you do your job and you, you know, you do what you can. You try and you hope and try to avoid the common, you know, mistakes. And then all of a sudden, for some inexplicable reason, really, you can't reduce this stuff like in any scientific sense and take it apart, you know, and say, oh, well, Star Trek was a hit because of, you know, William Shatner, oh, you know, just because of him. Or,
yeah.
Well, it was only because it was a hit because of Gene Roddenberry. It was a hit because of the set design or the dialogue or the writing. It doesn't work like that. What happens is that at a certain point, the whole becomes greater than the sum of its parts. With anything, with a movie, with a record, with a television show, and that's what happened, I think, with the Monkees. You know, the combination of the writers, the songwriters, the script writers, the directors, the producers, the four of us, I'd like to think we had something to do with it. And all of a sudden, it just sort of ignites, you know, and you can't reduce it. You can't break it down into any separate pieces. It just doesn't work like that.
The one element that the show has that so few other shows have are all these hit songs. So on top of everything else, you're talking about some of the best pop music classics of all time, and that just kind of put it over the edge.
Absolutely. That had a lot to do with it, of course. and the production of the songs and, you know, the singing of the songs. And, you know, you can't fool all the people all the time. And when you have material by Carole King and Neil Diamond and David Gates and Boyce and Hart, don't forget, Boyce and Hart were integral. They were integral to
right.
the success of those songs. So they produced them also, wrote some of the biggest hits, and produced some of the biggest hits. And they were the ones that were probably most responsible for creating the original sound of the Monkees, because that's what producers do. That's what they did, especially back then. The A&R people at the record company and the producers would find, you know, some band playing in a bar in Texas and say, you know, we want to groom you and take you out to L.A. and groom your look and groom your sound. And that was typically how it happened, you know. Not anymore, unfortunately, so much, because the A&R departments of record companies, you know, hardly exist anymore. But back then, that's what producers did. And so when we were just, like I say, it was just the perfect storm, you know, it just all kind of fell together.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace. A doubt in my mind. I've been lost. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried.
I just want to ask you two more questions, Vicky. I'll let you go. But one thing that's sort of part of Monkees lore is the brief tour you did with Jimi Hendrix. And we know
I'll tell you, it was quite simple. I'd seen Jimi Hendrix in New York playing as a sideman for, I think it was John Hammond or somebody, at one of those New York places, the Lamplight or the Bitter End or something. And he was introduced as, well, not introduced, but somebody said to me, you got to go down and see this guy play guitar with his teeth. And I was like, cool. So we went down to this club, and sure enough, there's this guy. And I'm sitting front row center, and he's playing guitar with his teeth. I think he was known as Jimmy James at the time. And then I never heard anything else about him or from him until I'm at Monterey Pop Festival. And all of a sudden, these three guys come on stage, and I look up and I go, hey, that's the guy that plays guitar with his teeth. And, of course, it was the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and they weren't very well known yet. As you know the story, he went to England, and Chas Chandler basically put together the Experience with Mitch and Noel. So I guess, in a way, they're a manufactured group, right? And he introduced Jimmy and Mitch and Noel, and they became the Experience, and of course were just, you know, fantastic. Anyway, I saw him at Monterey, and I suggested to our producers, since we were looking for an opening act for the tour at the time, and I said, this guy's really great, and he's very theatrical, because it was a theatrical act, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, and you know, the Monkees was theatrical. And I guess they liked the idea, Chas Chandler and our producers, they made a deal. And sure enough, he was the opening act for, I think, 6 or 8 shows. It was strange. I do the story on stage before I play Purple Haze. I tell the story of him, you know, going out on stage and, starting Purple Haze and you know, Purple Haze is in my brain. We want Davey. We want the Monkees, Mickey. And that's typical. You know, it's happened. It happens, you know. Like, I remember at a Rolling Stones concert when Guns N' Roses were opening before they were very well known, and the crowd was, you know, screaming for the Stones.
Right.
The funniest one, though, is when I was at the Whiskey, and the Doors were the house band, and we would go down and they would open the shows with some, you know, Jim Morrison and the house band, the Doors.
Yeah.
And one night I remember Johnny Rivers, and he was huge there at the Whiskey. And Johnny Rivers was there, and they were screaming. People were yelling over the Doors songs, "We want Johnny! We want Johnny!" I forget what you're... But basically, you know, the audience is, you know, they're there to see the Monkees and their little 12-year-old kids. And so, and then he broke a record. He broke his record. We had a number of different opening acts. We had the Fifth Dimension. We had Ike and Tina Turner. We had Lulu, of course. We had, in 86, we had Weird Al Yankovic. And also Debbie Gibson opened for us once before she had, you know, hit real big.
Any memories of hanging out with Jimi Hendrix on that brief tour, just backstage?
Yeah, you know, we would watch him from the wings and, of course, just be, gobsmacked at the talent. We hung a lot off stage. I hung a lot with him in New York at Electric Circus, and we would hang out, you know, in the rooms. And there's photos I have of him and us sitting around jamming in a hotel room. And he was a lovely guy. He was very quiet, very sweet, very, you know, naive a little bit, but just the consummate, you know, genius artist.
Chips and the dips and root beer, even though dark purple rain clouds are near. When you come around, you bring the summer.
Well, last year, you guys hit number 14 on the Billboard 200 with Good Times. It was your highest charting album in 48 years, so it's an unbelievable legacy you guys have.
Unbelievable.
Good. I love the song. I was just listening again. You Bring the Summer, written by Andy Partridge of XTC. It's just such a perfect mix of the 60s sound. It still works. That jangly pop is just sort of timeless.
Yep, it is. And we just, again, it's another good example of just the perfect storm. You know, I'll tell you, the story, not that complicated. A couple of years ago, we started talking about the 50th anniversary and what we would do, and you know, touring came up, and a record came up, and TV came up, and we simultaneously, you know, but we were trying to figure out, you know, between us and the record company, Rhino. What are we going to do? Are we going to write all the stuff ourselves? Are we going to play it all like headquarters? Are we going to get different producers? And are we going to get different writers? And so, simultaneously, we found in the vaults a number of unfinished tracks. Some more completed than others. Some with vocals. Some without. But they weren't just demos. They were multi-tracks. So clearly they were the beginnings of what were going to eventually be finished and mastered and released. But then the show went off the air, and we stopped making albums. And so we ended up with this massive amount of material, unfinished material, and we went through a lot of it. And we found a couple of things that were very, very interesting. One was a song by Carole King that she'd written and that Peter ended up doing. And another one by Neil Diamond that had a Davey vocal on it.
Right.
a good vocal, you know, not just a scratch vocal. But they were unfinished. And then the thing that tipped it over the top for me was we found a song that Harry had written and done a vocal on for me to eventually sing. That was Good Times. And when I heard that, it was him on piano, Mike on guitar, and a couple of other musicians. And I heard that, and I went, my God, I can sing a duet with my old friend Harry Nilsson. And the record company went nuts, and I went nuts. And I'm the one that suggested we use that as the title track, Good Times.
Right.
And, of course, Harry never did demo vocals. You know, he was always flat out. So his vocal is stellar. And I like to think that I kind of tried to keep up with him on it. And that sort of gave us conceptually an idea. The record company then went to Adam Schlesinger, who I knew of because of Fountains of Wayne,
right,
of course.
Yeah.
And that thing you do, which I remember at the time when it came out, people said, you got to hear this song and see this movie. It sounds like you. And I did, and of course it did. In fact, I bumped into Tom Hanks at a party once, and he said to me, hey, I made a movie about you. And I met with Adam, and we hit it off, and he obviously was the perfect call. He was very excited about it. And then they started reaching out to people, and of course I'd heard of Noel Gallagher and Paul Weller and Andy Partridge.
Right.
But frankly, I hadn't, you know, the name sounded familiar, but I wasn't that familiar with Death Cab for Cutie or Weezer. And I told my wife and my daughter, and they're like, you're kidding. You got a song by Ben Gibbard? And you got a song by Rubus Cuomo? And I'm like, yeah, cool, huh? And so they
that makes you
out.
Cool.
It turns out that these guys were huge fans, and they submitted material. And not stuff, you know, that, in the bottom of their drawer. This is stuff that had been written specifically for us. And so it just all fell together. Adam Schlesinger did an incredible job. The album sounds like it was all recorded on the same day in 1967, you know. So, yeah, I'm very, very proud of it.
Future of the Monkees?
Well, we had a hell of a year last year touring, and of course, without David, you know, without David. And
right.
Then Mike toured with us for a while. And now he's writing a book. There are no immediate plans for any Monkey Business, because frankly, we're still riding along the crest of that, of the success of that album. And I'm doing a lot of solo shows, and I do songs off the album in my solo show. So there's no decision. It's not like, well, we're not going to do anything, or we are going to do something. It hasn't come up. I have other things going on, and I think Peter does too. So basically, it's a wait and see, like it always has been, you know.
Your legacy on Billboard charts is right up there with some of the top acts of all time. So continued congratulations from everyone at Billboard.
Thank you so much, sir.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.